You're listening to This Week in Palestine, a space rooted in truth-telling resistance and uncompromising solidarity. Here, voices from the front lines of occupation rise to meet global movements for justice, dignity, and liberation. Each week, we bring you reporting that refuses to flinch, analysis that cuts through the noise, and commentary that centers Palestinian life in all its complexity and courage. We trace the architecture of empire from policy and propaganda to daily survival and grassroots defiance, and explore how those same systems reverberate across borders, linking Ferguson to Jenin, refugee camps to classrooms, and Gaza to the global conscience. A brief note, the views expressed during this hour belong to our hosts and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This is not a space for polite avoidance or sanitized soundbites. It's a space for truth, bold, urgent, and unapologetic. Thank you for being here. Let's begin. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. Good morning, good evening, wherever you're tuning in from across the globe. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Muhammad Al-Ghul, and it's a deep honor to welcome you back to This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, August 24, 2025. And once again, our focus returns to Gaza and the West Bank, lands under siege, where homes are shattered, lives uprooted, and voices too often drowned out by global indifference. As headlines fade and attention shifts, the reality remains: families endure displacement, communities resist with unshakable resolve, and the struggle for dignity continues against staggering odds. And still, one haunting question echoes: how long must the people suffer before the world chooses conscience over convenience, action over apathy? Stay with us as we uncover truth, uplift resilience, and carry forward the flame of justice. This journey is not mine alone, it's ours. It's shared. And it's sacred. Over the past century, Western powers have invaded, manipulated, and destabilized the Middle East and Africa under the guise of security, democracy, and economic development, but nowhere has this legacy been more brutal, more enduring, and more morally bankrupt than in Palestine. The story of Palestine is not just one of occupation, it is a mirror reflecting the machinery of empire itself. After World War I, Britain seized control of Palestine under the colonial mandate system, laying the groundwork for Zionist settlement and displacement. The infamous Balfour Declaration of 1917, which promised a national home for the Jewish people in a land already inhabited by Palestinians, marked the beginning of a century-long betrayal. Western governments, particularly the United States and Britain, have since armed, funded, and diplomatically shielded Israel as it carried out ethnic cleansing, military occupation, and apartheid policies. From the Nakba in 1948, when over 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes, to the ongoing siege of Gaza, where over 2 million people live under blockade, the West has not only enabled these crimes, it has actively participated in them. The justification has always been the same: security, stability, counterterrorism. But behind those words lies a deeper truth: Palestine is a strategic pawn in a global game of control. The U.S. sends billions in military aid to Israel annually, while vetoing every U.N. resolution that seeks accountability. European powers sell weapons, normalize diplomatic ties, and criminalize Palestinian resistance. Meanwhile, Palestinian life is reduced to rubble, refugee camps, and headlines that vanish within days. The West's interventions in the broader Middle East wars in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Afghanistan follow the same pattern: invade, destabilize, extract, abandon. But Palestine is different. Palestine is the wound that never closes, the injustice that never fades, the resistance that never dies. It is the place where Western hypocrisy is most visible, where the language of human rights collapses under the weight of complicity. And yet, despite the tanks, the drones, the propaganda, and the silence, Palestinians continue to resist. From the olive groves of the West Bank to the rubble of Gaza, from refugee camps in Lebanon to student protests in Boston, the struggle for liberation persists, and now the tide is turning. Around the world, people are waking up. Jewish voices are breaking ranks with Zionism. Youth movements are demanding divestment. governments are being pressured to cut ties. The myth that Zionism equals Judaism is unraveling. And the truth is rising. Zionism is a political ideology rooted in colonialism, not a faith rooted in justice. Judaism teaches compassion, memory, and dignity. Zionism enforces borders, bombs hospitals, and builds walls. The difference is not abstract, it is lived daily by Palestinians who suffer under its rule and by Jews who refuse to let their identity be weaponized. As BRICS nations rise and Western influence wanes, the global order is shifting. The question is no longer whether Israel will be held accountable, it's when. And when that reckoning comes, it will not be led by governments, but by people. People who refuse to be complicit. People who demand justice. People who understand that Palestine is not just a place, it is a moral compass. To stand with Palestine is to stand against empire, against racism, against repression. It is to say, no more stolen land, no more silenced voices, no more genocide disguised as defense. The West invaded Palestine not just with tanks and treaties, but with ideas. Ideas of supremacy, control, and erasure. But Palestine has answered with stories, with steadfastness, with survival. And that is why it will never be defeated. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. As the world begins to understand that Palestine will never be defeated, that its people, culture, and resistance are too deeply rooted to be erased, another question rises with equal urgency. Where are the Arab countries? And more pointedly, how and why have they failed Palestine and Palestinians? For decades, Arab regimes have spoken the language of solidarity while practicing the politics of abandonment. From the halls of the Arab League to the borders of Gaza, their actions, or lack thereof, have exposed a painful truth. Many Arab governments have chosen stability over justice, silence over resistance, and self-preservation over liberation. Historically, the Arab world was once galvanized by the Palestinian cause. The colonization of Palestine by European Zionists was seen as a flagrant injustice that unified Arabs across class, sectarian, and national lines. But over time, that unity fractured. Western powers, particularly the United States, successfully pressured and incentivized Arab leaders to normalize relations with Israel, marginalize Palestinian voices, and suppress pro-Palestine activism within their own borders. Today, countries like Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE maintain diplomatic ties with Israel, even as Gaza burns and the West Bank is carved up by settlement. Some, like Egypt, have gone further, sealing borders and refusing entry to fleeing Palestinians, effectively aiding the siege. Others, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, have pursued economic and military partnerships with Israel, prioritizing trade deals and regional influence over moral accountability. And while Arab streets erupt in protest from Rabat to Amman to Beirut, these regimes respond not with support, but with crackdowns. They fear that Palestinian liberation is contagious, that it might inspire their own populations to demand dignity, democracy, and self-determination. In truth, many Arab governments see Palestinian nationalism not as a shared struggle, but as a threat to their own authoritarian rule. They have turned their citizens into consumers, flooded their cities with distractions, and silenced dissent in the name of stability. But the people have not forgotten. Across the region, ordinary Arabs continue to march, organize, and speak out. They know that Palestine is not just a political issue, it is a moral compass, a test of integrity, and a mirror reflecting the soul of the Arab world. And they know that the failure of their governments does not absolve them of responsibility, it demands that they rise. The betrayal of Palestine by Arab regimes is one of the great tragedies of modern history. But it is not the end of the story, because while governments may falter, people endure. And the people of Palestine are not alone. They are carried in the chants of protesters, in the art of exiled poets, in the prayers of millions, and in the quiet defiance of those who refuse to forget. The question is no longer where are the Arab countries. It is, when will they be held accountable? And how will the people reclaim the promise of solidarity that was once the beating heart of the Arab world? The answer begins with truth. and truth, like Palestine, cannot be defeated. Today, we bring you a vital clip from the Chris Hedges YouTube channel, featuring an unflinching interview with Dr. Farah El-Sharif, a conversation that cuts through the fog of diplomacy and exposes the raw truth about Arab and Muslim regimes and their betrayal of Palestine. Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and former war correspondent for the New York Times, has long been a moral voice in the wilderness. His reporting spans decades of conflict from Central America to the Balkans to the Middle East, and he's known for his fearless critique of empire, militarism, and the corporate state. Hedges doesn't just report facts, he interrogates power. His platform, the Chris Hedges Report, has become a sanctuary for voices silenced by mainstream media activists, scholars, and survivors who speak truth to power without apology. In the episode Arab Regimes and the Betrayal of Palestine with Farah El-Sharif, Dr. El-Sharif, a scholar and former associate director of Stanford's Abbasi program, delivers a searing indictment of the complicity and cowardice that define much of the Arab world's response to the genocide in Gaza. She argues that many Muslim leaders have stood by and watched the slaughter of their own people in exchange for petty crumbs from Western powers and the Zionist state. Her words are not just academic, they are deeply personal, rooted in a lived understanding of how colonial borders, imperial agendas, and internalized oppression have fractured the Muslim world. El-Sharif explains that the psychological damage runs deep. Many Muslims, she says, have internalized the rhetoric of the war on terror, becoming apologetic about their own faith, history, and identity. This, she calls a decimated consciousness, a condition where people no longer know their own truth and begin to accept the narratives imposed upon them. The interview is a masterclass in clarity and courage, and it's part of a broader tapestry of Hedges' work that includes episodes like Chris Hedges' speech on Gaza, The End of the Western, The Last Days of Gaza, and the 100-year war on Palestine with Rashid Khalidi. Each one peeling back layers of propaganda to reveal the architecture of violence and resistance. Together, Hedges and El-Sharif offer not just analysis, but a call to conscience. They remind us that the betrayal of Palestine is not just a failure of policy, it's a failure of moral imagination. And they challenge us to confront the systems that enable genocide, not just in Gaza, but wherever empire casts its shadow. Let's listen.
The Muslim world has been tested with the weakest, most corrupt, and most hypocritical scholars and rulers because, as a community, our priorities have long been in the wrong place, writes the Islamic scholar Farah El-Sharif. After being ravaged by colonialism, we no longer rallied behind the core characteristics of true leadership, prophetic knowledge, principle, and integrity. We no longer valued what is just and true. We chased after the fickle mirages of autocratic power, wealth, charisma, and status. This was our downfall. As a result, we today see tight-lipped, impotent Muslim rulers idly watch the river of blood as it flows from Gaza. We see compromised scholars betray the Quranic command for justice and bend their heads in humiliation and fear of worldly powers. Save for a few, most Muslim rulers and scholarly elites have chosen self-preservation and silence. The river of blood in Gaza is also a river of treachery and collusion. With leaders like these, it is no wonder the Muslim world is in the sorry state that it is in today. Palestinians could see from the very beginning that there is nothing post about the post-colonial world order, she continues. They have ever since got less and less of their rights, lands, and dignity with each passing day. In the same era, the opium of nationalism spread like wildfire as the Muslim world was carved into colonial-constructed nation-states. The rest of the Muslim world enjoyed its false sense of sovereignty and accepted its bridle. Divorced from the lonesome plight of the Palestinian people, fooled into believing that the same system that gave birth to their sovereign states could guarantee their safety and protection. What, she asks, is the Muslim body today, if not diseased, aching, and wounded? Joining me to discuss the state of the Muslim world, the connection between repressive Arab regimes and the so-called war on terror, and how the genocide in Gaza expresses or exposes the moral rot within Arab ruling elites and the efforts by the West to manufacture a compliant form of Islam is Farah El-Sharif. She received her PhD from Harvard's Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations Department with a research focus on Islam in Africa and the Levant, the modern nation-state, and Muslim political movements. She is currently a visiting scholar at Stanford. You can find her work at sermonsatcourt.substack.com. Farah, let's begin with the state of the Muslim world, the Arab world, which, from the quotes that I pulled from the introduction, is, you call it a diseased body, but it's also a created body by Western powers, propped up by Western powers. You grew up in Jordan. The Hashemite rulers of Jordan were imposed on the Jordanian people. Jordan didn't exist, of course, at the beginning. Transjordan, whatever you want to call it. They are from Saudi Arabia. The oil interests created the rulers of the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And this has just been a kind of legacy, whether it's, you know, Sisi in Egypt or, you know, any other kind of pliant ruler. So let's talk about the state of the Arab world, and let's talk about, and we were together in Jordan this summer, the failure on the part of Arab rulers to push back in any, with the exception of Yemen, of course, push back in any meaningful way against the genocide of the Palestinian people, and then in many cases actually collaborate with the Zionists to overcome the maritime blockade imposed by Yemen.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Chris, for having me and the generous introduction. Really, it's if you ask any person in Gaza, they will tell you that the thing that hurt them the most was not the American, German, and Israeli bombs. It was the cowardice of kin. It was the collusion. It was the abandonment with this kind of Zionist campaign to exterminate them. That is what is the source of their true emotional and psychological scar. So to say that the Muslim community worldwide is stuck between a rock and a hard place is probably the understatement of the century. So if it isn't these bombs, quadcopters, drones that are shredding our bodies and burning our children alive, it's these colonially installed puppets that look towards this a model of empire and salivate over it, competing in who gets to please it the most and who gets to bend over to be compliant towards it. So these security states have our people strangulated, whether it is through surveillance, repression, or intimidation. And if it isn't the horrific Sidnaya prison that we've seen footage of and other sadistic torture dungeons under Assad Syria, it is the hundreds of other unknown torture cells still operating in the West Bank, Egypt, Saudi, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Jordan, East Turkestan, and India, Kashmir, where political prisoners are detained by the hundreds and held under gruesome conditions, often without charge. So if it isn't that, it's the Israeli soldiers that relish in breaking the bones of Palestinian children prisoners. It's Deitamin concentration camp where Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya was abducted over a week ago with no word from him, and where Dr. Adnan al-Bursh of a Shifa hospital was brutally raped and killed before him. It is the crude and sadistic Israeli parliamentarian urge to protect the so-called right to rape. If not that, it is the moral stain of Abu Ghraib. It is the Patriot Act that detains people like Dr. Afia Siddiqui, the rest of the Holy Land Five, and men like Abu Zubaydah, Guantanamo's so-called forever prisoner, or America's tortured guinea pig, who still resides in Guantanamo since 2002, and who we forget is of Palestinian descent himself. So this, like you rightly pointed out, Krish, this systemic repression that Muslim communities worldwide experience is inextricably linked to the interventionist, expansionist, supremacist, American-Israeli-Western project. in a twisted way, they kind of all work together like this pharaoh behemoth protected by Orwellian buzzwords like liberal democracy or state sovereignty or the so-called rules-based order, which Gaza has exposed as nothing but a ruse-based order. So it is as if this entire ecosystem of repression feeds on injustice. And we've reached the abyss of the abyss of repression. And this world order is this Frankenstein-like world whose horrors have been unleashed primarily on innocence. So what the great African American theologian James Cone called structural sin, we've reached an alarming level of that, of desensitization to atrocious mass violence. And what does all of this do? It kills and strangulates all of us, not just Muslims. It produces this endemic spiritual death, which affects not only Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians, but humanity as a whole. So this pernicious web of carceral cancer is sustained by the politics of compliance to an empire which sees like Muslims like me, Palestinians and Arabs as mere fodder for this monstrous system. Nowhere is this collusion more evident than things like basic human rights and civil liberties being eroded in the West. Look at the state of Muslims in Germany. Or just last week, I think a senator from Florida, Randy Fine, tweeted essentially a final solution, a call for a final solution, saying that it's high time we dealt with this fundamentally dangerous culture, i.e., Islam. Well, what I would say to that is, what is fundamentally dangerous and broken of a culture is one that has normalized genocide, one that is okay with watching images of people being burned alive and moving on with their day. That is what is fundamentally broken, and that is what is dangerous. So this manufacturing, decades of manufacturing, the Muslim menace, this idea of the war on terror, or let's change that preposition and call it a war of terror, a war of state terror that has Muslim political prisoners locked up and exterminated. This same campaign also sustains and funds the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the ongoing land grab, annexation, and colonization of land in Syria and Lebanon. And so all of this is part of a campaign to dominate and redraw the Middle East, straight out of a 21st century crusader, cum Zionist colonial playbook. Except this campaign is more militarized, it's more advanced, it's more funded and supremacist than ever before. So I don't think that this is a controversial point, Chris, but I wrote this in my Substack that we are currently living in an age of Muslim internment, but we don't call it as such. We've reached a point where we have normalized the genocide and extermination of a people deemed to be bad wholesale, according to the logic of the Judeo-Western Christian civilization. So, yes.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that since World War II, we've primarily normalized seeing images of torture, basically on Muslim bodies from Bosnia, Abu Ghraib, the Rabaa massacre, West Bank, and now in Gaza, the Rohingya, the Uyghurs. So it's definitely a time where a time of harrowing sort of desensitization and dehumanization on a global systemic level.
Well, as you are well aware, the United States acted no differently from Israel, as Israel is, of course, the genocide is more pronounced, but the kinds of the torture, the tactics, the indiscriminate killing, the racist language, this was all part of the project, the imperial project in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Syria. We have a kind of historical amnesia here in the United States. But certainly within the Muslim world, especially those people that have borne the brunt. I mean, how many, what is it, 1 million Iraqis were killed because of our occupation of the country? They don't forget. They know.
No, absolutely, Chris, you're right. And I think that You talked about with Dr. Gabor Mate, you talked about fragmented morality, but what we're seeing now in a lot of this knee-jerk geopolitical reactions to what's going on in the region, in the Middle East, is a kind of fragmented vision. And what you were saying about amnesia is absolutely true. So I'm trained as an intellectual historian where my job is to look at the long durée of ideas and look at the kind of the macro arc of where we're going as a human whole. And so I don't say this to be an alarmist. I'm probably the most anti, dogmatic person that you could talk to, but I say this not to kind of play the victim card that, oh, we Muslims, we need help, we're so helpless, and then turn that victimization into, furthering another kind of oppression or another kind of injustice. And we've seen that happen to many people who are oppressed or repressed. Suddenly they become the tyrant. And I think that for Muslims and Islam, we're at a kind of a turning point, a testing kind of Gaza has been kind of the litmus test for Western leadership to basically see if they truly are about the highest ideals of Western civilization, protecting the right to liberty, the right to life, the right to freedom. And it is clear, it is exceedingly clear that these freedoms only extend to the in-kind group. They're only seen as worthy to Westerners, to white people. Whereas when it comes to these barbarians abroad, let's just decimate them, let's just destroy them. And this arrogant expansionist program is very reminiscent of the 18th and 19th century colonial brutal campaigns that I read about when it comes to the French in West Africa or the Dutch in Indonesia. And it's exactly all from the same colonial playbook. Except now it is fattened up with this, like I said, this Orwellian cover of civility and democracy. And we should not forget that this campaign that we are seeing now is exactly out of Netanyahu's kind of wet dream for the Middle East to take all of it essentially. And in 1996, you know better than me, Chris, about the clean break policy that was designed to take out seven countries in 5 years: Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Sudan, Somalia, and then swallow the region whole. And for anybody to look at one regime change and to say that that's not part and parcel of this campaign. Even the war on terror was cooked up in Tel Aviv in 1982 or even before in 1979 through the Yonatan Institute that Netanyahu himself founded. He said, "We're done with the red threat now. Now is the green threat, that of Islamic terror." And so a lot of Muslims even internalize this war on terror rhetoric. And they themselves start being apologetic and say, oh, Islam is peaceful. Islam is this. Islam is compatible with democracy. Islam is compatible with civility. And I see that as a sign of decimated consciousness, not just double consciousness. They don't know their own faith. They don't know their own history. And so they start being apologetic about it. And that is a position of weakness.
Well, and you've written about this, there's a huge push to create this kind of Quisling form of Islam. That's what the Abraham Accords are. So, we divide, and this is classic colonial rule. We divide, let's put it in commas, the natives into the good natives and the bad natives. Those who are willing to serve in our colonial police force, like the Palestinian Authority, which is currently attacking Jenin. And has thrown Al Jazeera out of the West Bank, imagine, following, of course, Israel's example within Israel proper. Let's talk about that. The attempt to create divisions within the Muslim world and this insidious project, and the Abraham Accords, I think, epitomize that to create, quote unquote, the good Muslim.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very archetypal story in a sense that in every struggle for liberation, there will always be the collaborators, the native informants, if you will, who kind of throw their people under the bus and curry the favor of the powers that be and try to kind of gain favor in exchange for petty crumbs. But ultimately, history, scripture have shown us that it is a Faustian bargain. At the end of the day, these people who think that by cozying up with repressive forces of empire like Israel and the United States at the expense of the actual lives of the people they govern, they do that thinking that they're securing their reign, or that they are getting political expediency, or perhaps their son might become king next, or some kind of delusional worldly fantasy like that. But the funny thing that you mentioned about the Abraham Accords and how they are singularly pernicious, Chris, is that they use this language of kind of this prophetic authority. They invoke Abraham as the father of all three religions, and hence give this this kind of treacherous collusion a kind of a prophetic theological tinge. And this is again part and parcel of this Orwellian doublespeak, where this time they have Muslim scholars, even here in America, Muslim scholars who defend that, who are in cahoots with the UAE and Saudi, who are mum about the genocide in Gaza. And so historically, we've had Muslim scholars in the lead of anti-colonial resistance movements. Today, you see they're fully co-opted, or they're in dungeon prisons, like in Saudi right now. I read yesterday that every 25 hours, one person is executed under MBS's Saudi Arabia. The other day, just somebody I know was detained for around 3 months, a woman, for wearing a kufiya, a Palestinian kufiya, in the holy mosque of Mecca. So this is the kind of cancerous kind of relationship that I was referring to earlier. And the funny thing is, Chris, the irony about the Abraham Accords is that in the Islamic intellectual tradition, the Prophet Muhammad was asked about the Prophet Abraham and what he stood for. So one of his companions asked the Prophet, "Tell us about the Abrahamic scrolls." And you know what the Prophet said about that? He said, the Prophet Abraham used to speak like this: "Oh, you wretched, insolent, conceited king. I did not send you to this world to collect worldly benefits. Rather, I sent you to supplicate, or to respond to the supplication of the oppressed on my behalf, to respond to the supplication of the oppressed on my behalf." And this is the exact opposite of what the Abraham Accords, backed by the UAE and Saudi, Bahrain, Morocco, do. They actually strangulate the oppressed. They are actually all the people living under the rubble, or starving or dying from the cold in Gaza, were only able to get to that point because of the collusion and collaboration of Arab and Muslim normalizers.
Let's, for people who don't know what the Abraham Accords are, this is Jared Kushner's project under the Trump administration. Explain what it's, I mean, in its rough description, it essentially normalizes relationships, diplomatic relationships between Israel and Saudi Arabia at the expense of the Palestinians, of course. But talk about the Abraham Accords and why they are so pernicious.
It was signed in 2020, like you correctly said, under the Trump administration. It was you could say Kushner's kind of a vision, alongside Netanyahu, of course. And it was signed between the U.S. and people don't even realize that Palestine is not even part of this accord. They arrogantly cut out the people whose lives are affected primarily. Just this is about them. This is about Palestinians, and yet they weren't consulted. They weren't even present. And so this is part of this kind of effort to kind of enact this cultural change, to promote a kind of Islam that is a quietist Islam, that is just cultural, that is just cosmetic. Women in hijabs, great. Men who go to the mosque, great. This rote ritual type of Islam that is devoid of its true spiritual core, its prophetic calling, which is what to speak a just word in the face of a tyrant. That is the greatest jihad we're taught in our tradition. So it's only later, actually Saudi itself never signed this. There's an article, if you look it up, maybe 1 week before October 7th, MBS said, "We're very close to signing peace with Israel." And so even now, after the Gaza genocide, that has not been a disqualifier for any of these Arab regimes to stop or take back those treaties. They still have kept their word on these accords, on these peace treaties, these trade routes. And so when we say that these Arab armies, these militaristic behemoths, they've only been fighting their own people. They haven't been defending the oppressed that need them in places like Gaza. So, and now because of these Gulf states coming into the picture, we are seeing a more cancerous kind of form of normalization on the state level where you see even ordinary journalists, Muslims going online say, oh, you know, we need to coexist, we need to do that, we need to do this. But then how can you coexist with an entity that is essentially trying to basically decimate your entire religious character, your identity, your beliefs, your core scriptural commitments, let alone, you know, your brethren's bodies and their right to exist.
Before we talk about, I think you would agree, the kind of, well, to me, inexplicable silence on the part of many Muslim leaders over the genocide, let's talk about what these Arab regimes are actually doing in Jordan, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, the land bridge that was set up, the fleecing of Palestinians by Hala, the shooting down of the active assistance by the Jordanian, well, they say it was Jordanian, it was probably heavily American. When I was in Jordan, I was a little surprised to see so many American contractors and soldiers, not in uniform, of course, in the hotel where I was at. But let's talk about what they're actively doing. They're not just passive, but the active support for the Zionist state in the midst of the genocide.
Oh, yes. I mean, again, if we want to move away from having a fragmented vision in looking at specific states and how they approach Palestine, Palestine has been kind of a revealer and it's pointing us to the longer arc of history. I remind your listeners that these nation states were basically concocted out of a kind of a colonial kind of divide and conquer. Classic strategy after World War I, things like the McMahon policy or the Sykes-Picot. And so these states are cut from this kind of smelly leftovers of the French and the British empires. And people think that just when you declare independence or, you know, now you're sovereign, it doesn't actually mean that that we are free or sovereign. On the contrary, it means that the level of control and coercion and repression has gone underground, is more ambiguous, it's harder to locate. So that is why, for example, if you go to a protest in a place like a Jordanian university and you say something, you could get snatched up. Or in Egypt, you know, you express solidarity with the Palestinians. People are afraid to do that because they think that that could be cause for them to basically disappear and go underground. So again, this ecosystem of fear not only surveils and kind of mutes people who are so-called not in a in, who are in a, kind of not in the genocidal you know atmosphere. But I like what the there was an Egyptian taxi driver in a video that went kind of viral. He was he rode with a gentleman from Gaza, and when he found out that he was from Gaza, he started crying and he said, no, I won't take your money. And this is the least I could do not to take your money. Forgive us, for we are occupied too, he said.
اي حد سامحوا السيد محمد عبد المجيد سامحوه انا مش عارف اعمل لكم حاجه
And I think that is the sentiment that all Arabs feel, but that they cannot say, that we are also occupied. We are also under this thumb of this brutal repressive system, whereas Palestinians have had the courage to break free from that. So in a sense, Gaza, sometimes the Arabs say that it represents the most free place on earth because it broke out of that prison. And so a lot of these prisons that Arabs have, Muslims have in these Muslim majority in Arab countries are mental colonization. If they see a policeman on the street, perhaps they shrink and cower more. Even I grew up in, I grew up in Jordan. It's a police state. So I remember my dad, God rest his soul, he was a veteran journalist like you, Chris, and he was the editor-in-chief of Jordan's oldest daily. I remember it very well, that when we started talking about something slightly taboo or slightly dangerous, they would say, "Oh, the walls can hear everything." Or he would crack a joke and he'd say, "Oh, you're the neighbor's daughter. You're not my daughter," just to kind of joke like that. But these were the kinds of jokes that we, not funny, this is the kind of climate that we grew up in, and now to see it become in this form where it's a form of insanity, where you have your own people, your next of blood and kin being kind of exterminated right next door. And not only that, you see that the trade route that goes and funds the occupation, boxes and boxes of tomatoes and cucumbers and lettuce and produce that go to feed and sustain the settlers and the soldiers while Gaza starves.
Now,
And
let me
so,
just make clear that this comes in this pipeline, UAE, Saudi Arabia, through Jordan over the King Hussein Bridge.
correct, correct, Chris. And so, we should probably shed light on the plight of Heba Abu Taha, who,
Yes.
the journalist who merely conducted an investigative report about this trade route, this land, lifeline. For the occupation, and she is currently doing 5 years in jail and is paying very hefty penalties for so-called cybercrime. And this is the kind of it's kind of a warning for others that don't you dare expose complicity or collusion or collaboration because you'll end up in a cell or a ditch like her. So it's just the nice thing about it, Chris, though, it's like there's no ambiguity anymore. That people can no longer say that, oh, we should give them the benefit of the doubt. They're doing their best. It's a tough neighborhood. I hate this cliche. I hear it all the time. And they're always kind of invoking that. Oh, it's a tough neighborhood. Politics are dirty. But it's being blown off with crystal clear clarity that this is one occupation. It's one system. The enemy is one. And so it's up to people and their moral clarity and moral courage to every day shed a little bit of that fear, because once they partake in it and once they accept it, they say, "Oh, generations of people who live in fear, and I accept this." I think my generation and hopefully my children's generation will no longer accept that kind of degradation, denigration, and fear-based rule.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised the plight of Hawa, who, as you know, I tried to visit. I filled out all the paperwork and then sat outside the prison, the women's prison in Amman, all day and wasn't finally allowed in. How fragile are these regimes, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt? I sense they're very fragile.
Yeah, I mean, we forget that this nation state structure that was cooked up in, the kitchen of people like T.E. Lawrence and Sykes Picot and basically are constructs. They're recent constructs, and we think of them as, something that is the status quo since time immemorial, but they're really not. They stand on very fickle ground, as we saw, things can change overnight. And so it reminds me of the story of Pharaoh, who in the Quranic scripture that, we share with our Jewish and Christian brethren, is that right before when he got to the zenith of his power, right before he got to Moses, the sea split and swallowed him whole, and he became kind of, until this day, a sign and a kind of a lesson and a symbol for what happens to people who think that they are invincible, for people who think that they will live forever. And so God knows, what the future brings. But this level of foundational rot, I don't think can hold much longer.
Let's talk about you and I were at an event, it was a year ago in Toronto. We were talking about Palestine. And what struck me after we spoke is the number of young people who came up and asked me, and probably you, why the Muslim leadership didn't say what, well, it was not unequivocal in the condemnation of the genocide and unequivocal in the condemnation of the apartheid state of Israel. And I want to ask you that question. How do you characterize the response of the Muslim leadership in the United States?
Yeah, I remember that, Chris, and it was heartbreaking, and it still is. And I thought about this a lot, and I think it's largely due to the fact that this war on terror rhetoric that kind of weeds out the bad from the so-called good Muslims, the good Muslims who are compliant, who don't support so-called radical, brutal acts of terror. So it's almost as if this colonial rhetoric has been internalized in the consciousness of Muslim scholars and leaders. And so that they say that when perhaps that if we stand with the oppressed, if we speak up for Gaza, the powers that be might think that I support Hamas or that I support this and that. So again, it's like this, not just decimated consciousness, like I said, it's more than that. It's kind of capitulating completely because you're saying that the vernacular of justice has to be removed from Islam for me to have a seat at the table, for me to gain, proximity to power, maybe get the ear of Biden or get the ear of Trump. And I see this happening a lot that some Muslims are currying the favor of the right wing kind of platform and thinking that, oh, at least we meet on certain points regarding families and family values and whatnot. So to me, this just signals a huge crisis in our priorities. It signals a terrible misunderstanding of the true aim and kind of point of being a Muslim, and that is standing firm in your own principles and ethics and higher morality that is tethered to the throne of God, that is tethered to the oneness, the true oneness of God. So, other than oneness, what do we have? Multiplicity. And multiplicity signals, I'm afraid of this commitment. What if I do this? What if I say that? And so that is in a sense a kind of a hidden polytheism. And so when someone who has a position of authority and scholarship and people look up to them and then they lapse in that responsibility, the whole community is hurt. And the young people are like, where do I locate my Islam? Who am I? What does it mean? And so that is why I think, we are in this place. We're too comfortable with our salaries, upgrading to our SUV and our nice, respectable suburban life, while our brethren overseas get killed. It's a complete lapse of leadership and collective morality.
Explain to me this conundrum of Muslims for Trump.
I think I
It's kind of
get
like Jews for Hitler.
it.
I
Yeah.
mean, maybe not that extreme, but I mean.
No, but I mean that's where that gives you a window in how this destroyed kind of consciousness, this this severe inferiority complex, where you're willing to basically shut up and accept racist rhetoric about you and your people, and it's this amnesiac kind of just the Muslim ban is still it's still ongoing. Like there it's not like it ended under Biden. And so I it saddens me that Muslims for Trump is even a thing, because what you're buying into the very campaign that's going to probably deal the final blow. And already you can see how very vitriolic and toxic X and platforms like that are, and full blown Islamophobia, xenophobia, And there's this like maybe strongman appeal to people who think that, oh, well, this is a leader, and maybe these are remnants from autocratic nostalgia that I see bumper stickers in Amman for Saddam Hussein. I guess this is this idea that, okay, if this leader is strong and tells it like it is and he doesn't mince his words, then he must have something charismatic or strong. It's
Well,
bad.
at least, but at least Saddam Hussein was an enemy to the Zionist state. I mean,
Right.
I remember I was in Ramallah this summer with Atef Abu Saif, and he said, if you go in these houses, you won't see a picture of Arafat, you'll see a picture of Saddam. But Trump has never done anything positive for Muslims.
No. It's baffling, and it signals a dangerous level of kind of maybe collective insanity, but there are pockets of hope. I think that I guess by and large, this election cycle was manic for everybody. And I think we've reached a point where this lesser of two evils conundrum has reached a point where it can no longer be replicated in future election cycles. People are sick of lesser of two evils. They just want no more evil, no more. They just want the good, the true, something other than, an orange fascist in charge or a black woman who's, funded genocide. So this conundrum, it really, this strangulation, this chokehold that we're in, for me is a good thing because it signals that, okay, at least this Leviathan is probably taking its last breaths, and that more sane, conscientious people with a moral conscience, with a real pulse, with a real concern for humanity, hopefully, will be the ones to come next and inherit this ailing world.
So, where do you see us going in the months and years ahead? And then to close, what do you tell young people, in particular young Muslims? But let's just, I don't, for the foreseeable future, for me, it looks pretty dark.
It's a hard question, but also it keeps me up at night. I think about this a lot. I've always been this intense girl that my family makes fun of me, that even as a younger kid, I was always brooding and thinking about the Muslim world, our affairs, our conditions. So I'd like to refer to a lecture that I was at when I was a student at Georgetown in 2008. My favorite Catholic theologian, Hans Küng, gave the Nostra Aetate annual lecture at the time. And he said something that really blew my mind. He said that in his comparing Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, he said that Judaism rests on kind of tribal hierarchical commitments. And so its natural culmination, its natural telos is this, the ethno-religious state of Israel. And that is its final conclusion. And then he went on to say that Christianity is beheld by the papacy and the institutionalization of the church. And that's its logical conclusion. When he talked about Islam, he said, Islam is in its essence universalist, and it's tethered by this idea of oneness of man and Muhammad as a mercy to all of humankind, not just Muslims. But their final arc or their final culmination has not been decided yet. So I call on my fellow Muslims to take this opportunity of rampant moral rot, of decay and destruction in the systemic world order that we live in, that has exposed itself as hypocritical, essentially anti-Muslim, brutal and completely inhumane, to kind of lean in to their agency as Muslims, that can perhaps bring about a brighter future, that can perhaps fulfill this untold role, a positive role collectively, for that Islam can offer the world. Because unless and until we remain shackled in our mental and spiritual colonized mentality, whether it is about how we know ourselves, how we know religion, how we conduct ourselves politically, we will never break free. And so we have the potential to do that. We have the potential to be like Malcolm. For me, he's the greatest American Muslim exemplar and courageous leader. We call him the great American Shaheed, the martyr of America, who he himself visited Gaza in 1964. And he said the spirit of Allah was strong in Gaza. So look to these people instead of trying to wait for your average imam or your charismatic sheikh to grow a backbone. You have plenty of exemplars within our tradition, living and dead, including the people of Gaza themselves. There is a Quranic kind of pointer there that the oppressed shall become the teachers. They shall become the role models of faith, similarly to how in Christianity the meek shall inherit the earth. So the kind of fortitude that the people of Gaza have, let that not go in vain. The other day I saw a video, Chris, that I can't get out of my mind, of a father holding the shroud of his child in the ambulance. And he was speaking so clairvoyantly, so prophetically, that it gave me goosebumps all over. He's saying, "Ya Netanyahu, Ya Arab, oh Netanyahu, oh you Arabs, oh you colluders, everybody who failed us, Allah is only raising you so that he can tear you down. So don't think that this, what you see, all of this supremacy, this militarization, this ironclad power, this supremacy is going to be the name of the game forever. It's only this shocking in its dehumanization, this shocking in its genocidal bloodlust, for it to hopefully wither away and usher in a different world, a better world.
Great. Thank you, Farah.
Before we close today's episode, I want to lift up three urgent calls to action, each grounded in solidarity, resistance, and the unwavering refusal to stay silent in the face of genocide. The first one, stand out to stop the killing in Boston. Every Tuesday from 12 to 1, PM community members gather outside the Zionist consulate at 20 Park Plaza, Boston, for the stand out to stop the killing. This is not just a protest, it's a moral stand. A public witness against the ongoing genocide in Gaza, a collective act of conscience that declares silence is complicity. We will not look away. This weekly action is a space where voices rise for the voiceless, where presence becomes resistance, and where humanity is reclaimed in the face of systemic violence. If you're in the Boston area, show up. Your body, your voice, your care, they matter. The second one. North Shore for Palestine and Salem Farmers Market. On Thursday, August 28, from 4 to 6 p.m., join North Shore for Palestine at the Salem Farmers Market, 21 Front Street in Salem. This gathering demands an end to the starvation in Gaza and affirms our collective commitment to Palestinian liberation. If you're in the North Shore, come out and lend your support. This is a chance to connect, organize, and show that our communities will not be silent. Together, we stand for justice. Together, we make it impossible to ignore. The third one, mobilize for divestment campus and community campaign. Across the country, students, faith leaders, and grassroots organizers are launching divestment campaigns targeting institutions that fund or profit from Israeli apartheid. Whether you're on a college campus, part of a congregation, or organizing locally, now is the time to demand that your institutions cut ties with genocide. Start a petition. Post a teach-in. Pressure your school board, city council, or union. The movement for divestment is growing, and every voice adds weight. And that brings us to the close of today's episode of This Week in Palestine. As always, stay curious, stay courageous, and keep asking the questions that unsettle power and move us closer to justice. I'm your host, Muhammad Al-Ghul. And it's been a profound honor to share this space with you where truth is spoken, resistance is honored, and solidarity is never negotiable. If you have reflections, questions, or want to support the work we do, we'd love to hear from you. Reach out anytime at twipodcasts@gmail.com. A heartfelt thank you to you, our listeners, and to the brilliant team behind the scenes who make this show possible. Deep gratitude to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Moza, Dr. Rana Awad, Dr. Bethany Marks, Juliette Salama Halavieh, and Rinad Al-Ghul. Your vision, labor, and spirit fuel this platform, and keep its heart beating. Until next time, keep walking toward truth. Keep walking toward Palestine.